Well, thank you, Peter, for that very kind introduction. And more generally, I'd like to thank the board and members of the RSL and Services Club Association for their invitation to speak to you all here today in Hobart. I thought I would today consider three closely related questions, which are ones that I'm really frequently asked. So the first of these is how can the Australian economy become more productive? The second is what will help to generate the additional growth in demand that's needed to boost employment? And the third is where is that growth? Where is that growth going to come from? In particular, which industries will have the profitable opportunities that will lead to more employment and drive investment? Well, it's hardly surprising to my mind that Australians are interested in these questions, given the rise in the unemployment rate and the subtrend growth of the economy over the past couple of years. So let me start with the first question, how to be more productive. Excuse me. Well, from the middle of the previous decade, Australia enjoyed a sharp run-up in the prices of our key commodities. That led to an unprecedented boom in mining investments, the benefits of which were spread beyond the narrow confines of the mining industry in numerous ways, with strong growth in employment and wages across quite a wide range of industries right around the country. But now that commodity prices and mining investment have turned down, it's natural to ask, how are we going to sustain, how are we going to build on our standard of living over the longer term? Well, to my mind, this boils down to two essential elements. We can also work more efficiently. In other words, we can boost our labour productivity, and that's the source of sustainable gains in wages and profits. I've spoken elsewhere about participation, so today I'm going to focus on productivity. So there's really three, if you ask an economist, there are a number of sources of growth in labour productivity. First, perhaps, is technological progress, and that supports new business processes, new production techniques, as well as more efficient use of productive resources. In other words, an expansion of what economists call the technological or productive frontier. There's additional physical capital, both public and private, some of which may embody these new technologies. And then, of course, there's more human capital, more education, more training. And these things have somewhat formulaic air to them. They suggest we just need the right combination of inputs. Somehow we can produce goods and services as efficiently as possible. But for that to lead to sustainable growth of incomes, of wages, of profits, what we really need is to make sure that the goods and services that are produced are those that people want at a price they're willing to pay. Also, we need to fund investment. We need to do that from domestic and foreign sources of savings, and those are provided with the expectation of a reasonable rate of return. Now, a market-based economy can achieve those things with the help of competitive and flexible labour and product markets. And what they do is they provide important price and wage signals, encouraging labour and capital to move into profitable opportunities and out of unprofitable ones. Competitive markets also encourage companies to seek out efficiency gains, pursue innovations, develop new products or processes, and take advantage of scientific progress. Those are the key drivers of long-term growth. Now, it helps also, of course, if those markets are supported by a robust institutional framework. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean such things as the rule of law, effective regulation and oversight of parts of the economy, including to ensure a sound financial system, and institutions to oversee the efficient provision of public services and infrastructure, encourage prudent management of fiscal and monetary affairs. So, we're known at the bank for our graphs. I've got a few for you, not too many, I hope, to overwhelm things. But here's a favourite of mine, productivity growth in Australia over a reasonable period of time. Now, productivity growth was especially strong across many countries, including in Australia, over the decade starting in the mid-1990s, that middle block there on that chart. Now, there may have been some common sources around the globe for this strong growth. An obvious candidate is technological progress. In the case of Australia and a number of other countries, though, a range of earlier reforms may have also played a role. These include a broad-based deregulation of financial, product and labour markets, a further liberalisation of international trade, and a program of corporatisation and privatisation of public enterprise. While these things, they don't push out the technological frontier, what they do is they help provide us with an environment that encourage and enables us to get closer to that productive frontier. So following this period, though, there was a time from the mid-2000s, this middle patch here, sorry, I'll use the mouse, not to great effect, this middle patch here, there was a time when productivity growth was considerably slower than its long-term average, and this slowdown also was common across a number of economies. But what you'll notice from the most recent episode is that productivity growth has picked up in Australia in recent years. Some of this reflects the move from the investment to the production phase of the mining boom. So what that's done is seen a strong rise in output in that sector, combined with a reduction in employment in resource-related activity. But the pickup in productivity growth is broadly based across other sectors of the economy. So you can see a pickup even if we exclude mining and utilities. This may in part reflect the response of businesses to rising competitive pressures following the period when the exchange rate had risen to a very high levels. Growth of non-mining activity had been relatively weak, and wage growth had been relatively strong. So responding to those sorts of pressures is not easy. A common theme from our fairly extensive liaison program, where we talk to businesses on a regular basis over recent years, has been the heightened focus of those businesses on reducing costs, improving productivity in response to the subdued growth in their demand. In more extreme cases, however, it involves businesses that are not sufficiently productive or profitable going out of business, and of course workers therefore losing their jobs. So what more could be done to secure strong productivity growth? As others have noted before me, there are experts, and those experts are at the Productivity Commission, and they have put together a list of what could be done. And that list describes how improvements to incentives, to capabilities, and to flexibility could enhance productivity. Again, just let me emphasise, the idea is not that these things can push out that technological frontier, but they can help us to get closer to it. So recommendations to improve incentives largely focus on promoting competition, such as further reducing barriers that inhibit international trade or new entrants coming into markets. Policies on capabilities focus on the development of human capital, on education, improving infrastructure and government services, as well as the institutions for creating and transmitting knowledge. And the third part of the list deals with providing a more flexible regulatory environment, reducing unnecessary red tape. Now, any one of those things by themselves arguably will be helpful, but to my mind, I believe that it's likely that the combined effect of all of them will be greater than the sum of each of the parts. So that sort of discussion just briefly is focused on how economies can support growth over the longer term. You'll note, however, I haven't said much about the role of monetary policy. So while monetary policy can help to ensure low and stable inflation and contribute to macro stability, it cannot influence the longer term determinants of growth. Even so, monetary policy has an important role in influencing economic activity over the course of the business cycle, and that's the subject of the next question. What's going to help generate the additional growth in demand over the next couple of years? So just quickly on the chart before I get into the details, this shows the unemployment rate. And it's broken down into these different shaded regions between when the unemployment rate's rising and when it's falling. And you can see when it's falling, it's typically that average GDP growth is relatively high. And of course, when the unemployment rate is rising, that's when the GDP growth is relatively low. Well, since about mid-2012, Australia's GDP growth has been a bit below its trend, and the unemployment rate therefore has been rising, but it's been doing so gradually. The bank's recent update to its forecast, that's pushed out the time at which we see GDP growth picking up from its current subtrend pace. Now, it's not that economic growth has weakened of late, but there is little to suggest in the data that we look at that it will increase in the near term. So what does that mean? Well, this implies that the unemployment rates are likely to rise for a bit longer and peak a bit higher than we had previously thought. The question then is what will generate the improvement in the rate of economic growth and lead to a decline in unemployment? What are the sorts of triggers for such a revival? Well, part of the answer is that the very low level of interest rates that we have now is expected to sustain strong activity in the housing market and support household wealth. That will provide some support for consumption, although the response of consumption to low rates may be somewhat less and work in different ways from previous episodes, in part because of the higher levels of household indebtedness that we now have. Low interest rates also work by raising overall cash flows for the household sector and by encouraging households to bring forward some spending from the future and lower their savings rate a little further. There's a lot in this chart, but I think it's helpful to look at what's happening around the country in different states. Looking back over the past year, what we can see is the effect of low interest rates at work. Dwelling investment is this thin blue bar here, this contributions, that's positive. So dwelling investment has grown strongly. It's made a contribution to demand across all of the states. Consumption growth, this brown chunk here, consumption growth has picked up a bit, particularly in New South Wales, but it remains a bit below average for the nation as a whole. Consumption growth is weakest in Queensland and Western Australia, and those are the states that are dealing with the direct effect of the decline in mining investment. Business investment is making a positive contribution to growth, though, in other states. Meanwhile, in line with fiscal consolidation, which is occurring at state and federal levels, public demand has made no contribution to growth for the country as a whole, but that contribution is somewhat mixed across the different states. Now, in time, a pickup in household demand, that should encourage businesses to increase employment, undertake more investment. And when that occurs, businesses will make more use of the funding that's currently generally readily available at low cost. Also, of course, exports, especially of resources, most notably LNG, liquefied natural gas, those are expected to continue to contribute significantly to growth, while declining mining investment and, to a lesser extent, fiscal consolidation are likely to weigh on growth over the next couple of years. Now, I think it's very tempting to think that economies are well served by being directed or guided in a way that will just produce the better outcomes that we all want. There is some truth to that. Monetary policy is certainly playing an important role, but it guides things rather imprecisely and with a relatively blunt tool of the overnight cash rate. Now, I think there are other means of adjustment, though. Economies are responsive in many other ways that don't require the active input of policymakers. The so-called invisible hand of markets, that can provide incentives for producers and consumers to alter their behaviours via a range of price signals. So the exchange rate, that, to my mind, is one key signal. The earlier substantial appreciation of the Australian dollar in response to those very high commodity prices for our exports was a signal for labour and capital to move into that resource sector. But for a time, the Australian dollar stayed high even after mining investment and commodity prices began to turn down. That meant it was not playing the usual role of helping to rebalance growth towards other parts of the economy. However, the Australian dollar has depreciated by nearly 20% on a trade-weighted basis, 20% since its peak in mid-2013, and is starting to play a role in helping the economy to adjust. Australians and foreigners will direct more of their spending to Australian-produced goods and services, such as tourism, education, as they become relatively cheaper compared with the alternatives available offshore. And along the same lines, the depreciation has lowered the level of Australian wages when we measure them in foreign currency terms. So, for example, since April 2013, Australian wages are 30% lower than they were in US dollar terms. So while the depreciation seen to date will be helpful, it's still our assessment that the exchange rate remains relatively high given the state of our overall economy. A change in the growth rate of wages, shown here in the top panel in Australian dollar terms, that's also an important source of adjustment. Just as wage growth picked up when conditions in the economy were stronger, the growth rate of wages has declined substantially since about 2012. The lower growth of wages, that does work to depress the growth of incomes for those in employment. But remember, at the same time, lower wage growth allows for more employment than would otherwise be the case. And that works to support the growth of total labour incomes. In a similar vein, the pickup in productivity growth that I referred to before, the pickup over recent years means that the cost of obtaining the labour required to produce a unit of output, that's this unit labour costs in the lower panel here, the cost of obtaining that labour has not changed for 3 years. So let me just summarise a few themes there. The economy is currently operating somewhat below its productive capacity. The forecast is for a gradual increase in the growth of demand and employment, and eventually a rise in non-mining business investment, all of which supported by the very low level of interest rates. The lower exchange rate will offer some support to demand for Australian-produced goods and services, and adjustments are occurring along other dimensions, such as gains in productivity, slower growth of wages, both of which will help place the economy on a stronger footing. So that's what I think can help in time to generate some more growth. It's based very much, though, on my macroeconomic perspective. It draws on the history of business cycles. So it's only natural, I think, that people want to ask for more tangible evidence regarding the prospects of growth. And where's the growth going to come from more specifically? And in some ways, that's the hardest of the three questions. Where's the growth going to come from? It's difficult to know what new products and companies will come along, which products and companies they may displace. And while no doubt there'll be further technological innovation and progress, it's hard to predict how that will affect specific industries, especially for those that are not yet in existence. Nevertheless, I think we can say a few things about the general forces and the trends that are likely to be with us for some time. There's quite a bit in this table, but essentially what it is just showing you, comparing 1984 to 2014, and how much households were consumption expenditure was devoted to these different categories, the two big ones, of course, being goods and services, but I've broken out a few of the service industries for you. So one of these trends is the increasing importance of household and business services in the economy. And as you can see from this table, over the past 30 years, households have increased the share of their spending devoted to services from about 53 to 65% of their total consumption. So health and education, they account for a large part of that. Households are also spending a larger share of their growing incomes on recreation and leisure services, as well as communication and financial services. The shift in spending away from goods reflects, in part, the fall in the relative price of goods. In turn, that reflects stronger productivity growth for goods relative to services, as well as the development of lower-cost manufacturers in emerging countries. That is, the world has just become much better at producing goods, so their prices relative to services have fallen. Mirroring these trends in consumption and production, the share of employment in household services has increased from about 25 to 33% over the past 30 years. And this includes employment in accommodation and food, arts and recreation, education and training, and healthcare and social assistance. These are all the things we want, all the things that we need more of as our appetites for goods become more easily satisfied. Our business services, they've increased substantially as a share of output and employment. In part, this is because it's become increasingly cost-effective for businesses to outsource a lot of their non-core functions to other more specialised industries. Just to give you an example, an accountant that might have said they used to work for a manufacturing firm, they may now be counted as being in the business services industry, helping out a wide range of different companies. Resource production and exports, they're likely to continue to go strongly for the next few years as these LNG facilities, these new ones, ramp up their production. And while many people across a wide range of industries help to put those facilities in place, a much smaller workforce is required once they enter into production. Mining more generally is likely to continue to account, though, for a relatively small share of total employment. Manufacturing. Manufacturing output has increased over the past few decades as a whole, but not as much as output from other industries. And that's a common thing to most developed economies, reflecting this increased demand for services that I've just mentioned and the emergence of these lower cost manufacturers in emerging economies. The high level of the Aussie dollar has also weighed on manufacturing over recent years. Those manufacturers with more exposure to construction, including in mining, more focused on complex, highly skilled techniques, those have tended to fare better than those exposed to the more to the pressures of international competition from emerging markets. The depreciation of the Australian dollar over the past year or so is expected to support the expansion of industries in the traded sector. And I think this will benefit both the goods and services industries exposed to trade. Exports of services, shown as this line here on the right-hand panel, exports of services, they include education and tourism, as well as business services. Those were worth about $60 billion in last year. And at current prices, they, as a collection, they were a touch higher than iron ore exports at the end of last year. Most of the growth in services exports is attributable to rapidly growing economies in the Asian region. And you can see our exports going to Asia. I've just excluded Japan, which is not so rapidly growing, in the lower line on the right-hand panel. So these service industries, they should benefit from further strong growth of demand from that source in Asia, with many more households in Asia gaining a foothold in the middle class. And while Australia has many strengths in these service industries, our comparative advantage here is perhaps not quite as obvious as it is in mining and agriculture, which benefit from our substantial endowments of natural resources. So that means that we'll need to continue to work hard to maintain competitiveness in those industries. So let me draw a few conclusions together. I think the Australian economy has good prospects for growth over the longer term. Among other things, we have the advantage of a well-educated workforce, we've got strong population growth, we've got a robust institutional framework. Also, we're closer to a rapidly developing part of the world than we are to many slower growing developed economies. We have benefited too from earlier reforms. Among other things, this has left us with more flexible and competitive product and labour markets than we had in the past, and helped us to get closer to this technological frontier. However, other countries will continue to pursue reforms, and we certainly can't rest on our laurels. The Reserve Bank's central forecast for economic activity is for growth to gradually pick up over the course of the next couple of years. Monetary policy has and will continue to play its part in that regard. The depreciation of the exchange rate seen to date is helpful, and we shouldn't forget that there are other sources of adjustment, including this pickup in productivity growth over recent years. However, as we in the bank have emphasised regularly, forecasting is difficult, there are many uncertainties, and better growth is not guaranteed. It's difficult also to know exactly where that growth will occur. The very low level of interest rates, that suggests that housing market is likely to remain strong. We'll probably see a continuation of trends such as the growing importance of services in our economy, which is relatively intensive in employment. In resource production and exports, they're less employment intensive, but the significant investment in that sector will continue to bear fruit for a long time. And finally, a lower exchange rate will provide support for demand for the output of a wide range of firms operating in the tradable sector. So let me finish there, Peter, and hand it over to you for some questions.
Chris, while people are getting organised, somebody's going to ask me this question, so it might as well be me. Given the sluggish growth in non-mining investment that you described there, what are the odds on another interest rate cut?
It's a good question.
Is it going to help if we do?
Good question. I mean, I think the best thing I can say there is the board made it fairly clear in the governor's media release after the last meeting when they didn't cut rates, having cut rates by 25 basis points in February. So they have said that a further easing of policy may be appropriate over the period ahead in order to sort of foster sustainable growth. The board will assess the case for such action at forthcoming meeting. So that's about as clear as they want it to be, as clear as I can be. So it's a good question, and I can't really add much more than that. So, you know, it may be appropriate.
Yes.
But that's not the case that they're considering at forthcoming meeting.
Good. Okay. We've got a question here on the floor. Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Kemp, Penny Wilson from the RSL Services Clubs Association in Queensland. I once read a book by Robert Hughes called First Abolish the Customer, and the general thrust of that was export your jobs overseas and you won't have any customers. In view of the fact that a lot of major banks, manufacturing, car industry and others are exporting their jobs overseas, and I know you've really touched on this, but in particular, where do you see the jobs of the future? And in view of the declining job opportunities, where are the jobs for the over 50s going to come from, do you think? Especially as the government is looking for us to work till we're nearly 80.
Lots of good material in there. Let me do my very best to try and address all of them, but by all means, shout out when I missed this one aspect of it. The jobs offshore is a good question. I think my response is that we really opened ourselves up to more free international trade over the course of the last few decades. And that's happened at a time where we've had pretty strong population growth. And if we go back to, this is quite the right chart, but if we go back here, although the unemployment rate is certainly relatively high over recent years, it's much lower than it has been at these peaks before. In other words, we have managed to generate sufficient jobs for our population over the much longer term, and that's a period where we've really opened things up. It's true that some industries have been in decline while other industries have expanded more, particularly, as I suggested already, in the services sector. Those jobs are actually can be quite well paid and require reasonable levels of education and skilling. The other aspect of the movement of jobs offshore, we have to remember, to some extent, what that's often doing is lowering a particular cost for businesses, and often for many businesses. So that helps businesses that are still here, and even some of those that are, as use this word, offshoring, which I don't really like, but just English doesn't ring true to me. But this offshoring helps lower costs for lots of businesses, which makes them competitive in the things that they're good at. So that was the first one. I missed your middle question, then I said the question about the over 50. Well, I think the question about employment, as I suggested, it's very hard to know exactly where the growth is going to come from. I think, you know, in the near term, we're getting quite a lot of growth in the construction industries, in the housing market. That's natural when the interest rates are as low as they are now. Consumption growth has picked up, and that's fairly broad-based, but it's still, it's better than it had been, but it's still below average. What we are looking for is more growth in time to come. In terms of the over 50s, I gave a speech on a sort of participation and ageing last year. One remark was suggested the 50s and the 40, and you can extend that beyond there if you like. I mean, we are living and working, we are living longer, generally living healthier, and we probably should be working longer as well. Where are those opportunities? Again, I think I can't be specific to where they are for older Australians. But I think, you know, services, as I suggested, is kind of where our economy is going. We still have a very strong resource sector, very strong agricultural sector. Manufacturing is less strong than it has been in the past. But that's a feature that's common to many developed economies that have become much wealthier than they were 30 years ago, notwithstanding.
Okay, we've got a question over this side.
Tony Williams, Bucktown RSL. First question. You spoke about the devaluation of the dollar. When you look at the population, it's 45% of the population are in the aging group, you know, and all the self-funded retirees. You know, we are getting caned, you know, by the low interest rates. That's my first question. Secondly, to talk about manufacturing, you know, a lot of companies went overseas to China because they thought it was cheap labour over there, which was a false economy as far as Australia's went. Because when they got the stuff manufactured over there and the Chinese wanted to copy it and make a better job of it and selling it back to us on the market, on the white market, that's hurt our industry pretty heavily. You talk about export of education and so forth, you know, is our biggest, was more so than all iron ore is sales to Asia. But when you go to our universities, you find that all the positions are taken by Asian students, Indian students, everything like that, who can pay their way to it, where the Australian students can't get in the door, so therefore our economy is suffering because our technology is going down, it's not going up. So there should be some way that the Australian government looks at and says, okay, we've got to train our own first before we start giving positions to the other countries. Then you talked about the housing boom. Where I live at the moment, all the houses have been chopped up or sold up by, you know, overseas investment, which is Chinese, and that are coming into the country. They're buying houses because they're cashed up. They're buying houses in my street, they're going for $1.5 million, they're just buying after another. It's pushing the housing prices up, so therefore the Australian families can't buy houses. And then Joe Lockie comes out and makes a statement to say that he is going to stop overseas investment. How's that going to affect the housing boom then, when you find out that the Chinese and the Indians and all the other countries, Asian countries who are cashed up, can't buy the houses here?
Okay, right. you've got about 16 to...
Tony, I'll do my best to just pick up a few of these. I did. So, low interest rates. I think we recognise, we understand that amongst older Australians who have their own savings, those savings, where those savings are in interest-bearing accounts at banks, for example, their incomes are not helped by lowering interest rates. And this comes back to my remark that monetary policy is a fairly blunt tool. It can't, it sort of is one interest rate for everyone, for the whole country.
So you have to then try and strike a balance between, you say, low interest rates, good for investment, bad for...
Well, it's bad for some sectors of the household sector. Those savers, well, there are some savers who are exposed to equities and housing, and those assets are benefiting from low interest rates. But for those who have a heavy focus of their savings is in interest-bearing accounts and banks, than they are. The thing is, though, that the household sector as a whole is still a net debtor. On average, the household sector owes money, and so the household sector, on average, benefits from lower interest rates. Their disposable incomes go up. And that is the sort of thing that leads to the better consumption that we've seen, and, of course, the extra dwelling investment that we've seen over the past year or two. I said enough, I think, about manufacturing. I think maybe just the thing on the house prices, and I've already just briefly mentioned them, that the sort of those who own an existing house have benefited from the increase in their wealth from that source. In terms of sort of foreign buyers, we've made submissions to recent inquiries about this, and our understanding of the data is that they are very active in particular markets, most obviously in Sydney and Melbourne, particularly closer to the centre of those cities. But this house price growth generally is fairly robust in terms of looking at what's happened over the past couple of years, and most of that reflects the
I've got a question waiting, but look, just before we finish with this housing business, is the extra money that's being put into housing investment because of inflated prices reducing the level of money that's available for consumption? I mean, your graphs indicate that we need to boost consumption in Australia. Are we going to be able to do that while so much disposable income is going into housing?
Well, there certainly are limits to the extent you want households to sort of gear up, and limits to sort of, you don't want them to reduce their savings too much. They've been reducing them a little bit, I know. But monetary policy just brings forward activity a little bit from the future, encourages a little bit more borrowing, a little bit more dwelling investment, and in time, consumption also tends to pick up. In part because consumption tends to increase when dwelling investment and dwelling and housing market activity more generally rises.
Gary Dixon's been waiting for a question.
Thanks, Dr. Kent. In our industry, the issue of consumption is very important because it's, as Peter indicated in one of his opening, that discretionary expenditure on recreation and dining and entertainment is our business. And there seems to be a very direct correlation between consumer confidence and spending levels in our businesses. Why, with those things such as interest rates and record lows, unemployment, although it's creeping up, it's still, quite reasonable levels compared to where it has been over the last decade or two decades. Why is consumer confidence still struggling? What have we got to do to get people to feel more confident that they can start increasing their consumption? Because we need to know this, because that's where our businesses are impacted. When consumer confidence is quite low, and it is a very low figure now compared to where it was 12 months ago. Why? What has happened in the economy in the last 12 months that's driven consumers to feel so uncertain that they're not prepared to spend at the levels that they were previously?
Well, I think you can come up with a number of plausible explanations as to why consumer confidence is where it is. So the surveys that we have a few surveys around essentially just asking households about their own finances, what they think about the economy. They are lower than they have been in the fairly recent past, but they're still only a bit below average. They can't be above average all the time, by definition. But they're a bit below average, and that's true to, I guess, the business confidence. It's a bit below average. Part of it may be the gradual rise in the unemployment rate. Part of it, I suspect, may just be the low growth of labour incomes because of the wages side. So while that means people who have a job are getting slightly less of an increase in their pay packet every year than they may have been used to. So I suggest that there's a positive side to that, in that there are more people with jobs because of low wage growth, and more people who are making manage to hold on to their existing job or people to get a new job. And that's very beneficial for labour incomes. But what is it that can be done? Unfortunately, we have interest rate lever, we don't have a confidence lever. We do what we can by trying to by having interest rates low and doing so in a carefully considered way that balances up all of this. There's sort of different pressures and forces going in different directions. But there isn't anything magic to it, and it's really hard to know. I think confidence will build over time. tends to build slowly and gradually, tends to be lost quickly. But as I suggested in my sort of concluding remarks, I mean, the prospects for this economy are generally very good over the long term for the economy as a whole, because of all of those things I've mentioned, all of the things that we have, but then other countries don't. So I think the prospects are good. When everybody will see that and respond accordingly, I'm not sure.
Okay, look, our time for this session is up, but we'll take one last question just to round off.
Sure. Good morning. Rob Trevena from Woodrow and RSL. I have a couple of questions. It seems to me that a lot of emphasis is put on the contribution of labour, the labour force. However, I'm concerned that the perfect example is the petroleum industry. It's a textbook case of oligopoly pricing. They don't compete in price. It's, as I said, that textbook case of non-price competition in the oligopoly market. But they have the signal, the price of petrol in Singapore. And then everybody moves in lockstep. We have just glibly announced, oh, the price of petrol has gone up because it's the pricing cycle. Gee, the pricing cycle is identical in, say, Wollongong, where I'm from. They all go up by the same amount. This is competition? No, it's not. And I'm wondering why, I know it's not monetary policy, but why the Blazers haven't, the so-called regulatory bodies, stepped in?
Okay, we'll just get Chris.
Yeah, well, look, I think the issue raised is a good one. A lot is discussed about regulation. We discuss a lot about regulations in the labour market, perhaps less so about regulations and deregulation in the product market. I think the Productivity Commission does emphasise the need to have reforms across a wide range of parts of the economy if we're to try and grow more strongly and have stronger sustainable growth of wages and profits. But that's about more competition in product markets as well as flexibility in labour markets. It's not just one